The blue one which you don't usually wear? If you call home right now, you'll find your wife there and remind her the coat is under your red dressing robe in the first closet. Mailer regarded her with narrowed eyes.
I thought you said you weren't a mind reader.
I never said that, Barbara replied, then pointed to Henry. He did, and I can only get impressions of lost articles. You did lose the pipe, and were just now thinking, where had you put it? And the only reason I know about your wife is because you say you can never find her when you need her. Barbara kept her face very straight, but Henry knew her to be possessed of a sense of devilment, very much in evidence under that air of innocent helpfulness. This finding was making far more impression on the commissioner than her location of Joe Blow. The comm unit buzzed.
They picked up a man answering that description. What do they do with him? He's demanding rights.
Mailer was unprepared for only one moment.
Search him. There's been a local robbery, and a man answering his description was seen nearby. You're supposed to find a wad of credits and papers. Invoke citizen search prerogative.
He's carrying roughly 8,000 credits, sir, said Barbara.
The heist was 8,000.
There was a second long, tense silence.
He's got it, sir. Book him.
The fleeting expressions on Mailer's face now told of intense mental conflict. He was a man to whom a miracle had been offered, and he was too scared to accept it. Barbara is parapsychic, Commissioner. We brought Goose Egg to prove to you on a scientific basis as reliable as ballistics, without a tea leaf in sight, that her mind generates a specific type of electrical impulse when she uses her parapsychic talent. She can't read your mind except when you, or anyone, are worrying about something lost, strayed, or stolen.
Stolen,
the commissioner pounced on the word. If you mean that hijacked shipment of crowd gas, Commissioner, said Barbara, it's in a warehouse with a south side feel. It's very dark inside, which hampers me. I can't see in shadows. I can make out some white air freight containers. They've a plastic feel rather than wood or steel. There's a geometric design in dark paint in the lower left-hand side. She frowned, and the goose egg chattered rapidly for a moment, and then toned down to a mild, normal swing.
I'm sorry. There simply isn't enough light there.
The commissioner snorted, but her information had obviously given him something to work on.
South side, air freight, white.
His fist slapped down an end key.
Jack, what air freight companies use white containers with geometric designs in lower left hand?
Oh, they do.
Now, what air freight companies use south side depots?
Oh.
Well, check your contacts, like, right now.
He turned a cold, dispassionate look on Barbara.
You can't be more specific?
Barbara gave Henry a quick glance before answering. I've already narrowed the search to a small section of the city with as many specifics as I can see. There can't be that many warehouses for air freight. I've done more than you've been able to, Mr. Mailer.
Now, just a minute, young lady.
You've had more than a minute, Commissioner, and my time is valuable. Barbara was on her feet, the electrode net in her hand.
We're wasting time with this one, Henry, and I don't like him. Miserable vibes from him, just miserable.
She left the room. Molly quietly began to pack up the goose egg, while the commissioner stared first at the open door and then at Henry.
She operates more efficiently with an occasional word or two of thanks, Mailer.
Most people do.
Henry gathered Molly into the curve of his arm, motioned courteously to Jerry to take the goose egg, and, wishing Mailer a pleasant good day, left.
Hey, just a minute.
Henry turned at the door.
As Babs said, Mailer, you've had more than a minute, and our time is valuable.
Does Charity have to be sedated again, Gus? Henry asked the center's physician. We've got her a temporary contract to find out the troublemaker in the Arrow Shirt Company.
Gus ducked his head, his face twisted into a grimace, wanting to say no and having to say yes. He leaned against the now flagged door to Charity McGillicuddy's two-roomed accommodation on the living floor of the center's warehouse building.
Even with the shielding we've got, Hank, it's not enough privacy for the empaths and telepaths.
Not enough physical distance. No way to get out and away from ourselves, if you get what I mean. We're sort of all crammed into this warren, despite the conveniences and amenities. You might say it's too much of a good thing. Too close a buddy-buddy act, like an overdose of euphorics. Everyone's high here on sheer good fellowship, and it's much too much for charity. Henry looked towards the corridor window with a projection of sunlight on the grass, a huge spreading beech tree, russet against an autumnally blue sky. Though it was so realistic that the leaves moved gently and the angle of sunlight altered slowly, Henry knew it to be only a projection, and his mind would not accept the fantasy that deluded millions of warren dwellers.
"Talent requires certain realities not obtainable in this age," Gus went on, "and one of the most important is physical freedom and elbow room."
He snorted, aware of the impossibility of fulfilling that requirement in Jerhattan's overcrowded boundaries.
"We've been offered that old game preserve and too goddamn far to commute, and most of us gotta."
Molnar was head neurologist at the Midtown Hospital Center, although he spent more time as the center's physician.
"Okay," Henry said. "I'll do what I can."
"Henry?"
Gus eyed his friend suspiciously.
"What are you up to now?"
"Me? Nothing." Then Henry Darrow assumed a crouched stance and rubbed his hands together, chuckling evilly.
"But destiny! Ha ha ha! I know when we twain shall meet. Soon."
Gus rolled his eyes heavenward to deal with Henry Darrow in this whimsical mood.
"Oh, don't worry, Gus," Henry said in a normal voice. "I usually call him, you know."
Gus nodded sourly.
"Content yourself," Henry continued, "with the enticing thoughts of dissecting my brain when I die and trying to figure out just how I do it."
"Ha."
"You can't subpoena Barbara Holland, not on those grounds, Commissioner Mailer," Henry Darrow said. "But you can hire her services from the center."
"What center?" demanded Mailer, looking scornfully around the minuscule space that served as Henry's office.
"The center we'll shortly acquire with the wages you'll be paying talents like Barbara and Titter Bailey and Gil Gracie and..."
"Titter Bailey?"
The commissioner hovered on the verge of apoplexy.
"Yes, Titter. He drank to stop finding things. Alcohol affects the parapsychic faculty. Sometimes it inhibits, as in Titter's case. Sometimes it sharpens."
"Now, just a minute, Darrow."
"My minutes are valuable, Mailer. I only have so many. You want things and people found. Barbara has that faculty, and so does Titter Bailey. Actually, Titter's much better for inanimate objects than Barbara. He doesn't like people. And the day you find out he's been drunk on duty, then complain."
"And you mean to stand there, young man, and tell me that I'm going to get shot at Saturday? Again?"
Governor Lawson tipped his chair back and roared with laughter. An exercise he broke off abruptly to glare with an intensity akin to hatred at Darrow and the wraith-like Steve Hawkins.
"So what else is new?"
"The predictive incident says that a .38 slug will penetrate the right ventricle."
Steve's voice shook slightly. Henry wondered if he'd made a mistake in bringing Steve, who was very new to his gifts and the center's staff.
"The man will approach from the left."
"What does it matter where he comes from?" the governor said sharply, hostily.
"Oh, I don't disbelieve you, Darrow. Or you, Hawkins. I've heard too much about you people to be skeptical anymore. But if I don't appear..."
"You have to appear," Henry replied.
"We ran the alternates through a probability computation and find that your appearance at that forum meeting must take place to sway a currently uncommitted 8% of the popular vote to your party. Without that 8%, you fail to receive the critical majority, and if you fail, the Laborites can obtain the plurality they need to effect a countermeasure that would have disastrous consequences on the economy."
Governor Lawson began a chuckle, his belly shaking first before the amusement was shunted up the rotund abdomen to the chest and finally became audible in the head cavity. Finally, Lawson's lips parted to emit a rich, juicy laugh.
"So that's the way it'll be, huh?"
"Yes, if your eloquence doesn't falter with foreknowledge."
"Huh? How's that?"
"You have been given a prescience of the immediate future. Such knowledge could in itself alter the circumstances of the future. We do not always have either the personnel or the foresight to modify the future.
In your case, we make an exception. A laborite majority is not a good thing for the talented.
Governor Lawson nodded in appreciation of that expediency.
Your man will intercept the bullet?
Henry nodded.
And the nut will be put away? That's better than leaving him free for another shot. Good. How many political figures does your group protect?
Those who need it. And we'd appreciate a kindly word for the center when Steve diverts that bullet.
Lawson nodded agreement.
Those who need protection. Or those whom you need, Darrow. No, don't answer that one. Answer this. Will I win this election?
Henry smiled slowly.
You know the answer to that one, Governor. But the fun lies in making certain you've played the game right. How far do you guys play fun and games?
Just far enough.
Now, Mr. Rambley, what seems to be your problem?
Not my problem, Mr. Darrow. Yours.
The Internal Revenue Department man smiled a thin, smug smile and began to pull IBM cards from his neat fake pig case.
Really?
We have here WT forms from the Department of Law Enforcement and Order, from Johns Hopkins, Bethel General, Midtown, from DuPont, Merck Pharmaceuticals. Need I go on?
Just as you please.
These salary chits represent the earnings of Barbara Holland, Titter Bailey, Charity McGillicuddy, Gil Gracie, Frank Nagelsko, Augustus Molnar.
Again, the IRD representative regarded Henry Darrow with a cute expression on his fleshless face.
I could continue.
Just as you please. I give every government official the courtesy due his office.
Henry inclined his head toward Mr. Rambley, who for the first time since he'd minced into Henry's tiny lair, looked nonplussed.
After all, some of my best people are employed by the government.
With an irritated sigh, Rambley closed the stack of cards and tapped them in an admonitory fashion on the desk.
Come now, Mr. Darrow. These people,
and he brandished the cards,
earn tremendous salaries, and yet there is no record of a single tax deduction, no returns.
They donate their salaries in toto to the parapsychic center. They lease their services contractually to the various employers. The parapsychic center files a corporate form to cover them.
Under corporation law, no one in their right minds would...
Rambley bounced on the end of his chair with indignation and disbelief.
I never said any of the parapsychic talents were in a right mind.
In fact, Henry went on with gentle amusement, there is every reason to believe that the core of the parapsychic is, if anywhere, in the left-hand part of the brain.
Mr. Darrow?
Mr. Rambley was on his feet.
You did say that you gave government officials the courtesy due their office.
Yes, didn't I? Consequently, you're wasting time, your government's and mine, Mr. Rambley. The individuals represented by those neatly slotted cards do donate their total income to the parapsychic center. Our accountant will be glad to show you the appropriate records and contractual agreements.
But I know that that Titter Bailey creature is driving a four-passenger, 350-horsepower vehicle.
Such an incongruity shocked Mr. Rambley.
Yes, Titter's always wanted to drive a big one. The car belongs to the center. You can check the registration papers.
And that Charity McGillicuddy has a blue ranch mink coat.
Indeed she has. She requisitioned it from stores about 4 months ago.
She requisitioned from stores?
She has a position to maintain now, and her appearance is of great concern to the LEO office. Think how embarrassing it would be for someone employed by the LEO Commission to be arrested for wearing stolen furs. Of course, Charity says that now she can buy him instead of lifting him. Half the fun's gone. But it gives her a great moral boost to wear blue ranch mink in the LEO block. We try to keep our workers happy.
Rambley had stared at Henry Darrow through this ingenuous explanation, but his indignation rose with every gently spoken word.
This won't be the last you'll hear from me, Mr. Darrow. You do not mock the Internal Revenue Department, Mr. Darrow.
He slammed the file cards into his case, hands trembling with outraged dignity.
You'll hear from us.
That's fine by me.
Just call ahead for an appointment. Only consider the fact that Senators Maxwell, Abrahams, Montello, and Gratz approved our corporate structure.
Rambley's eyes widened.
And the presidential advisor, Mr. Killeney, acted as our financial assistant. Don't you have his card in that file?
Rambley exited, reduced to mutterings.
Do you often trick your way into a private home, Mr. Darrow?
When I've been unable to secure an appointment any other way.
Yes, Mr. Henner.
Henry smiled pleasantly, trying not to glance with obvious envy at the spaciousness of the magnificently furnished living room. Such accommodation was almost archaic.
George Henner appeared more amused than irritated by Henry Darrow's impertinence as he leaned back in his Italian brocade armchair.
If it's money for your palm-reading, table-tilting, crystal-gazing tricks, forget it.
On the contrary, sir, I've affirmation that I can ask you to join our happy band.
Henry smiled at the surprise in Henner's yellowed eyes.
Join you?
Henner burst out laughing. His head went back, showing a veritable gold field of fillings in his upper teeth.
By God, Darrow, you've made my day. If you can't lick 'em, recruit 'em.
Actually, Henry went on smoothly, seating himself and crossing his legs, counterfeiting an ease he didn't feel. He noted the flicker of irritation in Henner's face, but the financier had a reputation of letting a man have enough rope to hang himself. Actually, Mr. Henner, your abilities in the financial world are as solidly derived from the parapsychic as my own. Incidentally, you're the crystal ball reader, although I see you've got a modern computer for stock market printout instead of the old glass case.
Henner gave an amused grunt, but said nothing, his silence a subtle prod to keep Henry talking.
You're known, Henry continued obediently, because that was the way the interview ought to proceed, to have a genius, a second sight into what stocks are going to rise, which will fall, what bond issues will pay the keenest long-term profit. And I can prove that you're parapsychic.
Henner cocked his head slightly to one side, his amusement deepening as he tacitly encouraged Henry to produce his proof.
Darrow spread the graph out on the table. I know you followed the news media coverage on us, so you're familiar with this sort of graph. What you may not immediately appreciate is the fact that this is your graph.
Henner became immobile with attention.
When you had your last routine physical a month ago, your physician employed a goose egg. He didn't realize that it wasn't his own office model, so he's blameless. You did, however, experience what we call an incident, and it is recorded on this graph, here and here. I believe the incident was in connection with the Allied Metals and Mining merger in which you managed quite a killing.
You don't read thought from an EEG graph, Darrow.
Hardly. But you placed a phone call directly you were through your physical to your office, and within the next few hours the merger was announced. But not before you had acquired a tidy pile of Allied stock. Are my facts correct?
Henner nodded slowly, his eyes narrowed to intense slits, watching Henry Darrow's face.
That's proof, Henry said, rustling the graph paper, that you're parapsychic, Mr. Henner.
The silence which ensued, designed to make Darrow exceedingly uncomfortable, did not. For a long space, Henry returned George Henner's stare, then folded his arms and gazed around the beautiful room. Finally, he turned back to Henner and smiled.
Blackmail? Asked Henner.
Darrow shook his head.
No, you'd be far too clever for that. No, I'd hazard the guess that you want to borrow my talent, as you call it, to make your fortunes. That would still be essentially blackmail, wouldn't it, Darrow?
Henry pursed his lips a little, expressing dubiety.
Well, then what is it you want from me? It's something.
Actually, it's the 12-acre tract of land on the Palisades.
Once again, Henry wished he were a telepath to read the emotions swiftly passing through George Henner's mind. He had startled the financier. He had touched the most vulnerable point of the shrewd man's life, his intense love and need for the beautiful estate of Beechwoods. It had been in Henner's family for 140 years, was a showplace which few saw.
And Henner's need of Beechwood's was as great, and for the same reasons, as Henry Darrow's.
How could you know?
Demanded Henner in a hoarse whisper. That the state intends to confiscate all privately held lands within 100-mile radius of the Jurhattan city limits? I know because it is as important to me as it is to you to know these things. Henner was on his feet, pacing to release the energy of his anger. In a barely audible monotone, he inventively assigned destinations to the state en masse, the needs of the unhoused, unwashed multitudes in general, and those particular officials who had failed to keep Henner's ancestral home inviolate. If, however, the property is already owned by a religious, medical, educational, or charitable institution, which will accommodate a sufficient number of our ever-expanding population, they cannot confiscate your property even under the terms of Section 91, Paragraph 12 of the Housing Act of 1998.
This is 1997, man. That act isn't passed yet. I can still defeat it.
No, it will be passed. Henner tried to stare that knowledge out of Henry's mind. And you know the inevitability, Mr. Henner. None of your contacts can hold out any hope of defeating that measure, nor of defending your Beechwood's.
And it's your table-tilting tea-leaf readers who will infest my home?
Your physical condition is poor, Mr. Henner, and your nerves damned near the breaking point. The solitude and privacy of this house and its grounds are vital to your life. It would be to any parapsychic mind forced to tune in on the emotional chaos that haunts the very air we breathe. You know you've been living on borrowed time for the past year. You know what alternative dwelling accommodations will do to you.
Do you happen to know, asked Tenner casually, for he'd got control of himself again, the exact date of my death?
As I know the exact time of mine, Mr. Henner. You will die of a heart attack. The aorta will be closed by a globule of the arteriosclerotic matter coating your veins at 9:21 p.m., exactly 1 year, 9 months, and 14 days from now. A gleam of challenge livened the deadly intent of Henner's gaze.
And if I don't?
If you don't, then revoke the grant of Beechwood's to the center. In the meantime, you'll have secured your last days in the ancestral home, which is your prime concern at the moment.
I could have a heart transplant.
Henner was clearly enjoying this. Not with a diseased liver and the condition of your arteries.
And that's your prophecy, Darrow?
A medical certainty, Henry said. I've toyed with the notion of a transplant myself, since my death will also occur from myocardial infarction on a certain May 12th at 10:52 p.m. But by May 12th of that year, I intend to have accomplished the major part of what needs to be done to establish a viable, self-sufficient, parapsychic center in North America.
On the Beechwood's estate?
On the Beechwood's estate. By May 12th, I shall be grateful for the peace and tranquility of my grave. Henner's eyes flicked from Darrow's to some inner middle distance. The harsh, cynical lines of the financier's face softened.
Ease after war, death after life does greatly please.
The words were softly spoken, but there was no quarter in the hard look Henner then turned on Henry Darrow.
In your scheming, where does this house end up?
As an integral part of the center. Henner's expression was ironic.
And my money? I've no next of kin.
Darrow laughed. You keep harping on your money, Mr. Henner. We don't need your money. Check our books on that. But only the center can offer one of its own members what his money hasn't been able to secure for him. For a long time, Henner gazed out the French windows that gave on the flagged terrace, toward the sweep of magnificent lawn and the superb beech trees. When Henner finally turned back to Henry, his hand was extended. The two men shook three times in the ancient custom of binding a bargain.
Answer me one thing, Darrow. Did you foresee winning?
I knew that we would eventually secure Beechwood's, Mr. Henner, he said, permitting regret to tinge his voice.
But I wanted your cooperation. Cooperation? You goddamn well know I had no choice.
Didn't you? George Henner had wandered into the graph room just as the first of the three incidents was recorded. He had the habit of appearing in the various departments, taking what he called a perverse interest in the eventual eviction of the center from Beechwoods. In point of fact, Henner had admitted to Molly Darrow that the center had given him something to live for. He'd been feeling much better since Henry'd conned him out of Beechwoods. Despite his professed intention of harassing Henry, George Henner's passing suggestions were usually solid advice. And despite his crotchety and often irascible manner, the Talents became fond of him.
"Got a strong incident," Ben Avedon, the duty officer, told Henry on the intercom, just as George Henner wandered into the graph room. "Patsy Tucker."
In moments, Henry and Molly arrived in time for Patsy's phone call of such details as she'd seen.
"I'm on the water again," she said, breathless in an attempt to verbalize before details escaped her. "And there are boats. Four. Sun's at a late afternoon angle on my left, so I must be looking north. There's land beyond the boats, pines, a bluff, and oil on the water. I can see it all rainbowy. The oil scares me. It's going to ignite, and then the water's covered with flames, and the boats are eaten up, and... Oh, it's going to be wicked, Ben. Can you locate? Have I given you enough? I can't remember any more, and the flames cover any details."
"It is a sooner?"
"Awful soon. Today, I'm sure of it. But it's morning, and I saw late afternoon. Is there time enough?"
"Sure, plenty of time. I'm feeding the computer with the data right now. Old didactic will pin the place down, Pat. But have you a notion about the size of the boats involved?"
"Oh, yes, of course. How stupid of me. I forget you haven't seen. One small, a pleasure craft. A power boat. No sails. That's the one that goes on fire. Two long low boats. I guess they'd be tankers. And a higher boat. I mean, one higher above the water. And they're all much too close together. That's the problem, because they'll all catch fire."
"A pleasure boat, two tankers, and a freighter in the late afternoon. That's fine, Pat. And the pines and bluff and being close together indicate a channel of some description. Now, think hard again, Pat. Did you see any markings on the boats? Funnel markings? Ensigns? Names?"
After a silence, Pat mournfully admitted seeing nothing because the fire and smoke occluded.
"Get one of the pyros on it," Henry told Ben.
"Patsy, Henry here."
"That's a good job, lass. Now take it easy. We'll buzz you back with confirmation."
"Grand work, Pat."
Henry disconnected her line, shaking his head, knowing how worried the girl would be until she heard they'd prevented the collision. If only there'd been markings to speed up identification. And then if the participants could be dissuaded from arriving on the previewed scene. He moved deliberately to the computer panel and began tapping out queries.
"Undoubtedly a seaway. Could be Sheepshead Bay Area, East River."
"No, not there."
"Or one of the canals."
"St. Lawrence, with tankers and freighters," suggested Ben.
"Or the Great Lakes," said Molly.
Before there'd been a printout on possible locations or what traffic was already in the St. Lawrence Seaway, a second graph began to chatter.
"Right on time," said Ben. "Here's Terry, our local friendly reliable pyro."
"How come you don't know, Hank?" George Henner asked, settling himself on a stool in the corner.
"Not enough people involved, George, and too close a range for me. That's Patsy's specialty, cliffhangers. Besides, don't you agree that the good executive makes all the long-range decisions and leaves the picayune nitty-gritty details to keep his staff occupied?"
George grinned, but he said nothing more, listening as intently as the others to Terry Clee's verbalization of his sight. The broad outline correlated with Patsy's, although he saw the event from a different perspective. He had sufficient detail on one tanker and the small craft to result in exact IDs for both from ship registration. And there was a tanker of the Iroquois line proceeding down the seaway en route for Toronto, ETA, 7:48 p.m. at that port. The small craft, the HB, was registered to an A. Frascati and was at that moment moored in a small boat basin on the American side of the seaway. Probability figures the cost of the collision and fire at several millions, and a 36-hour tie-up of seaway traffic, plus delayed cargoes, which would complicate schedules and routines for 92 companies, involving work loss of some 18,000 people.
Okay, Ben. Get out the usual warning format. See if Iroquois will listen to us.
And if Iroquois doesn't want to believe?
We get after this Frascati. In fact, he'd be easier to bully than Iroquois, but we've got to warn them, too.
Iroquois was suspicious and uncooperative, and in phrases just short of insult, refused to consider diverting the tanker. Its supplies were urgently required in Toronto by late evening. Frascati was not at his home, nor in his business office. Urgent messages were left for the man to contact the center before taking out his pleasure craft. Henry was dialing the Seaway Authority control when George cut the connection.
"I've got an idea, Hank," George said. "I've watched this routine so often and seen you insulted, ignored, and calumniated. No one trusts the altruist anymore, whether he's talented or not. You've warned Iroquois, tried to do them a favor. They aren't buying. Well, like the puppy who leaves too many messages, let's rub their nose in it."
"You mean let the accident occur?"
"More or less. Considering what's involved in terms of credit and work loss, and considering that I have shares in four of the companies to be affected by the snarl-up, will you play it my way, this once?"
Henry began to relax.
"What have you in mind, George? You did leave timed messages at Iroquois and for Frascati, didn't you?"
Ben Avedon tapped the computer panel.
"All time sealed, George."
"Fine. Now issue a fax warning to Seaway Authority. Then give me a few comm lines to work from and Molly to help me. Irene was telling me about their new oil pollutant at DuPont. This would be good PR for him. Always like to oblige friends. Which reminds me, you get on to Jim Lawson. Our revered governor owes you a favor or two for that bullet Steve stopped. And ask him for a few more VTOLs and a couple of frogmen."
"Why? You don't know?"
Henry grinned.
"Would you believe an educated guess?"
Henner chuckled.
"My, my, how the mighty have fallen. Guessing."
"Run the show your way, George."
"Yes, let a pro show you how, Henry Darrow. You're too damn soft. You talk too much. Action speaks louder than 100 of your talented words."
At exactly 16:32 hours of a bright spring afternoon, an Iroquois tanker, proceeding down the St. Lawrence Seaway, fouled its propeller on a tangle of steel cables, origin unknown. The tanker drifted athwart the current as a United Line freighter entered the narrow channel from the opposite direction. A second tanker, also United Line, making speed enough to reach Toronto Port by dark, cruised into the danger zone, although it was apparent that the Iroquois boat was in distress. Both United Line ships continued, evidently hoping to pass the injured vessel, one on the port, the other on the starboard. Likely they would have succeeded, but the HB, also impatient to reach port, came bucketing down the sea route. It swung rather close to the distressed vessel. As Frascati ever after maintained, he wanted to see if he could be of any assistance in getting a message ashore. A ridiculous alibi, since the tanker was well equipped by radio and shipshore telephone. Frascati's propeller became fouled on the same villain cable. The freighter began to pass the disabled pair, and her wash slammed the small craft into the Iroquois tanker. The United Line tanker was broadside of the Iroquois when her bow swung out. Tanker number two swung to starboard to avoid a collision, and her stern banged into Iroquois, splitting a seam in the aft oil hold just as the small craft was ground between the two bigger hulls. Its galley fires caught old grease and spread in the cabin as the yacht's gasoline tank was breached. Oil pouring from the Iroquois vessel would shortly ignite from that flame. At this point, the hovering rescue copters intervened as news media cameras recorded the event from every angle. Foam quickly doused the yacht fire, the oil pollution material gobbled up the spilt petroleum, and kinetics held back additional oil loss by pressure until the teleports could get the conveniently handy plates into position. Other kinetics and the frogmen worked loose the steel cable, and it was hoisted out of the way. Captain Frascati and the two crew members, his sons, of the damaged yacht were lifted up, and another team of kinetics kept the little ship floating until the belatedly arriving Coast Guard cutter could tow it into port. The Seaway was not blocked, since all four vessels were cleared out of the narrow channel before others made the passage. There was no loss of life,
and no long-term pollution of the water. The parapsychic teams were volubly and embarrassingly thanked for preventing a major disaster. And by cocktail time, everyone was pleased by the denouement, especially Patsy Tucker and Terry Klee. The congratulatory euphoria lasted 12 hours, at which point the Seaway Authority began to realize that matters had come to near disaster in an unprecedented way.
"What was the meaning of sending us only a fax to announce a major disaster?"
the Seaway Commissioner demanded in such stentorian tones that George Henner need not have listened in on the second comm-unit in Henry's office.
"You were informed by fax as usual," Henry replied in a mild tone of voice.
"By fax, when countless millions of credits were at stake, and blockage of the most important waterway in North America?
And do you realize that we have only just balanced the sea life ecology in that strip of waterway, that oil?"
"You were informed."
"Well, I'm informing you that you're in for a suit of criminal negligence."
"Negligence of what, Commissioner?" "You were informed 9 hours and 38 minutes prior to the accident by this ex officio group, which is not a government-sponsored or accredited agency. We act for and in the public interest, but we are understaffed and overworked. You could have queried this office for more particulars, although all we had were included in that fax. Your authority could have held back any one of the four vessels involved, thus preventing the..."
"Are you accusing the Seaway Authority of negligence?"
Henry held the receiver away from his ear, shook his head, and replied in his mildest manner, "Forewarned is forearmed, sir." He caught George Henner giving the high sign of approval.
"You'll hear from us, Darrow. You people can't get away with irresponsible behavior like this."
The connection was rudely and noisily broken.
"Did you figure a lawsuit in your calculations, George?" asked Henry.
Henner rubbed his hands together in glee.
"If they sue, we'd win."
Henry couldn't exactly share in Henner's gleeful anticipation. The precog knew of the multitude of lawsuits which would be served on talents in the next decades, and the sheer cost of inspired defense made him shudder. The money would be available, but it was credit that could be used to better advantage in training and identifying talent, not defending against misunderstanding and greed. By late afternoon, Henry's premonitions of immediate disaster were borne out by additional suits of negligence, which arrived from United Line, Iroquois Tankers, and A. Frascati.
"Let me handle this," George Henner told Henry and his hastily convened executive staff. "I don't need any crystal ball or anerotic graph needle to tell me how to manage this sort of crap."
Before he had Henry's voiced approval, he was on the wires to the major media networks, chatting familiarly with presidents and commissioners. By the time the films of the Parapsychic Center's assistants had been widely aired, with a few choice comments on how the center operated to forestall major disasters, the threatened legal action against the talents was withdrawn. Suits were entered against the Seaway for criminal negligence. Then the center, on George Henner's advice,
"Make 'em pay for it when they don't listen to you,"
sent bills for the rescue operations to Frascati, United Line, and Iroquois Tankers.
"And from now on, Henry," George said, "don't ever follow up your faxed warnings with personal phone calls. Don't be the supplicant, damn it. Be the prelate."
Henry watched with inner amusement as George Henner paced up and down the floor, his eyes flashing, even his stride firm and aggressive, so that Henry could see traces of the strengths which had amassed George Henner his considerable fortune, and which had overwhelmed less determined adversaries in the business world.
"There's no point in you bruising your larynx with persuasion. You've proved your worth over and over again, and this Seaway bollocks ought to make a validated parapsychic warning worth the paper it's printed on, even at the dreadful price of paper these days."
"A sound argument, George, and I appreciate your help."
George stopped mid-stride, glaring at Henry through narrowed lids.
"Yes, I am helping you, aren't I? Shouldn't do that, should I?"
"My friendly enemy," replied Henry with a laugh.
"Ha! Tell me that when my executors snatch the rug of beechwoods from under your telepathetic feet."
"And we need you, George."
Henry raised his voice to overwhelm Henner's snide remarks.
"If I can convince a skeptic like you, I'm well away to swaying John Q. Public to my side. He's more variable than you, and he will be the hardest to win over."
John Q. Public, however, quixotically decided the Seaway Authority had been foolish to ignore the parapsychic warning. Criticism was heaped on the Seaway from every quarter. Later, the authority was somewhat exonerated of primary guilt, since the court felt that good judgment on the part of any one of the other three skippers would have prevented the accident, and no costs were awarded the claimants. The official record cited and credited the parapsychic center with averting a major calamity and loss of life and property. All transport authorities were severely enjoined to heed any warnings from the center which involved public transport. For the next few weeks, all precogs of traffic problems, possible fire, storm, or spring floods throughout the world were instantly acted upon. The center was besieged with anxious calls about whether Mr. S. could undertake that long-distance flight, or Mrs. J. could safely make her annual pilgrimage from Florida to Wisconsin, and if there had been any precog about the transfer of cyanide cylinders to the authorized Atlantic Trench dump. Thousands of hopeful people applied for the simple tests, which would indicate if they possessed some useful talent. "It's an ill wind that blows no good," Henry remarked to Molly after another hectic day answering urgent calls and dealing with anxious queries. "I suppose so," she said, sinking wearily into the armchair of their private suite in the main house. "But I wish we had more goose eggs, or a surer way of spotting the live ones." "Any today?" Henry fixed Molly a stiff drink. "Yes," and she brightened as if she'd temporarily forgotten the event. "One very strong receiving telepath out of 45 aspirants." She accepted the drink, turning the glass in her hand as if the amber liquid held some other answer. "Henry, they come in so hopeful, and some of them leave so angry and disappointed, as if we ought to be able to find what doesn't exist." "Not your fault, love. Everyone wants to be in some way unique, and can't realize that being unique is a responsibility as well as a privilege. You can't cure that." "How strong's the telepath?" Molly brightened. "I think he's very strong, but he's been blocking thoughts, the way they all do, out of fear. He may need a lot of training." "No, not too much," Henry said easily, pulling his chair close to Molly and clasping her free hand. "Young fellow, isn't he? Welsh extraction, Welsh name, right?" "I just sent the report in," Molly began, startled, and stopped mid-sentence, arrested by Henry's knowing look. "Not another one, Henry." "They do seem to appear right on schedule." Henry grinned at her, but there was a shadow in his eyes. "Right on schedule. One day I'll be wrong."
"Don't, Henry."
She clasped his hand tightly, reassuringly, knowing the strain of his unfortunate infallibility, knowing that some of the events he foresaw he'd rather not have seen. "And he is, as you predicted, Welsh," she went on in a light voice. "By name, Davith Ap Owen. Very likable chap." "He's important?" Henry nodded. "He won't need more than some basic pointers and a few quiet weeks here to wash the noise out of his mind and learn to project as well as receive."
"Well, that's one on the plus side of the ledger."
She rotated her shoulders to ease the day's strains, but Henry's disclosure about young Ap Owen made her feel much better about her labors.
"When is he moving in?"
"Don't you know?" she asked in a bantering fashion.
"What I know, I wish I didn't. What I'd give anything to know, I have to wait and see."
She smiled at him lovingly.
"You mean if we retain Beechwoods?"
When he nodded, she chided him gently.
"How often have you been wrong in the merest detail?"
"It's not how often I'm right, Molly, love. It's will I be wrong this time, this once. This important, crucial, critical once. Such a terrible gift, love. Terrible when your knowledge means the loss of a friend."
"Henry, your recognition, the very challenge of the center," and her arm gesture encompassed all of Beechwoods, "have kept George Henner alive and kicking."
She peered into Henry's face, reassuring him by touch, word, and look.
"He's determined to do you out of Beechwoods, if only by a minute. That determination alone has strengthened his hold on life. I've seen his medical reports, Henry, I know."
She leaned back in her chair.
You've done him quite a favor, and he knows it. I shouldn't be surprised if he hasn't left the Center Beach Woods anyway.
He hasn't. He showed me the will.
Molly opened her mouth to say something, then thought better of it.
All right, Henry went on, catching her look of mischief. So he could write a second one in secret.
No, we've a wager on, and...
I know what you mean. Hoping to win the wager loses a friend.
I can see horizons wider than mortality.